Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What does it take to sell over $24 billion worth of real estate?
I have sold 2,327 properties in New York City.
You didn't originally want to go into real estate, which is always an ironic origin story.
Northern New Jersey, a town called Maywood. It's between Hackensack and Paramus in Bergen County. Third summer, I got my real estate license in New Jersey, and I was the assistant for an industrial broker.
26 years later, in 2014, that's when you sold Cushman & Wakefield for $100 million.
And it was like a ghost town, Scott. Unbelievable. No stores were open. There were no people on the street. There were no cars moving. The second after they think, hey, I need to sell, you want the next thing for them to think of is, hey, let me call Bob.
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. They supported the show for over 2 years now, and I've used HubSpot for the majority of my professional career. One of the most useful tools that is included in the HubSpot suite of products is Sales Hub. Sales Hub is an all-in-one platform built with the tools and insights that you need to communicate on a personal level with every lead, every prospect, every customer. It doesn't matter what kind of business you're building, Sales Hub makes it easier to close more deals and drive more revenue. If you're looking for a better way to acquire customers, and we all are because that is the lifeblood of our business, if you're looking to make smart, data-driven decisions, increase visibility, productivity, predictability of your revenue, you gotta look at Sales Hub. It can organize and sort deals in your pipeline. It creates reminder tasks for your most important deadlines. It manages leads. It automates outreach. It tracks and closes deals all in one place. And on top of that, it's free to get started and it grows with your business as it scales. There's 1,300 integrations and a ton of valuable add-ons. Customize it exactly to your needs. With Sales Hub, closing deals is no longer a big deal. Go to HubSpot.com/sales and try it for free. Bob, thank you for joining me. I appreciate you a lot. I'm very excited to dive in. I always like to ask a question that's going to sort of kick off the conversation in a meaningful way. And the one that I thought of for you was, what does it take to sell over $24 billion worth of real estate?
Well, Scott, first of all, great to be with you today. And look, the real estate brokerage business is not a flashy or glitzy business. And most of it is just very basic blocking and tackling, we call it. So I think to sell, and I'm up to just under $22 billion. I have sold 2,327 properties in New York City, and the way we did that was just one at a time, it's just a focus on doing fundamental basic stuff, but doing the right stuff, working really hard, getting lucky, and just keeping at it, having the discipline to just do those very basic fundamental blocking and tackling type things over and over and over. And I tell people, come up with a formula, implement that formula and do it day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. In my case, decade after decade. We're now in year 40, but just absolutely love it. And it's doing some very fundamental things. You know, you always give the client advice that you think is in their best interest. The easiest way to do that is just pretend that your client's your mom or dad. You know, if they own the property, what would you tell them? Give people good advice, create value in yourself in terms of being an expert in a segment of the market that you can clearly articulate to the client your expertise and that you can really help them. and do the right thing and just, you know, get up every day and get on top of the rock pile and swing away. And you just keep at it for a long period of time. And before you know it, the numbers kind of add up.
You know, it's funny. It's just like age old advice that can apply to any entrepreneur ever. You do it for long enough, you build your systems, you build your processes, you incorporate your learnings. It's going to end up being impressive over 40 years, which is absolutely wild. And yes, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to add an extra $2 billion on there. I'm just forecasting out.
I think that happened early on. I had at the end of one of the years we were counting, it was $20.4 billion.
Okay.
Somebody said, "Oh, $24 billion."
Move it over.
20.4. Now it's exactly as of the end of last year, it was 21.8. So closing in on 22.
So you didn't originally want to go into real estate, which is always an ironic origin story. So maybe just walk us through that and how you got into it. Because I mean, you know, you accidentally fall into something, but then you're successful on purpose. So where did you come from that pushed you?
In northern New Jersey, a town called Maywood, which is, nobody's probably ever heard of Maywood, but it's between Hackensack and Paramus in Bergen County, northern New Jersey. 1981, I was a freshman at the Wharton School, wanted to be a Wall Street guy like every other Wharton kid. Thought it would be great to have a job at a commercial bank or investment bank on my resume. So I went around with my resume spring break freshman year, dropping it off at commercial banks and investment banks, came out of a Payne Weber office, saw a Coldwell Banker across the hall, thought it was a bank, dropped my resume off. They called me later that day. I set up an interview, go to the library, look up this bank, see it's a real estate company, almost don't go, but they were the only ones hiring college kids for the summer. Took the job, loved it, actually had a really interesting class my sophomore year. It was entrepreneurial management, and we had a guest speaker that came in, and he said, "You know, I know all of you probably want to be investment bankers, because 20 years ago I was sitting where you're sitting today, and I got to tell you, I sell dog food for a living and I'm the happiest guy I know." And he went into this whole thing about how he got into pet food and pet supplies, and he just found something he was really passionate about. And he says, "Look, don't worry about the, wanting to get a job that you'll make a lot of money at. If you're getting in the business world, if you achieve anywhere near the top of that industry, you're going to make a ton of money. So do something you really love." And it hit me. And I said, "You know what? I really love what I did last summer. I'm going to do real estate." And I took real estate classes, went back. I had done market research that first summer with CB. Second summer, I ran the market research group. Third summer, I got my real estate license in New Jersey, and I was the assistant for an industrial broker. And I was driving around Morris County showing industrial space to tenants and buyers. And it was just a great, great job. And then that third summer, the guys in Hackensack said, "Hey, we'd love for you to come work full-time here after you get out of school." And I said, "Well, thanks, you know, I appreciate that, but, you know, can you set up an interview for me with the guys in New York? I think I might want to go talk to them." And went to talk to the guys in New York, and they offered me a position also. And I thought, you know, like the song says, if you could make it there, you could make it anywhere. So I wanted to go to the Big Apple and try my hand at it. And that was 40 years ago. So just amazing run.
How different was real estate in New York 40 years ago compared to the environment that we have right now?
Oh my gosh. Well, in environment, the environment in terms of deal making was a lot better in 1984 and 5 than it is today. But the world has changed so much, Scott. It's just unbelievable. When I was sitting at my desk in 1984, I had no computer on my desk, no laptop, no fax machine, no cell phone. We used to carry rolls of quarters around in our pocket so that we could stop at phone booths out on the street and call people if they didn't show up for meetings. It was a very, very different time. And interestingly, you know, I think that even with the way the world has changed over the past 40 years, I think the extent to which the brokerage world is going to change over the next 5 years is going to blow away the change that we've seen over the last 40 based on AI and new technologies that are being developed. It's really mind-boggling what's going on today, and the rate of change is going to be much faster than it's occurred previously.
And I'm also curious about, because when I look at the real estate market now, it seems like there's a lot of realtors out there that are just getting started. Was it as competitive back then in the 80s as it is now? Has it always been that competitive? Just to understand what the dynamics were for like you getting that job and you making your mark and how successful you were.
Yeah, well, I think the world has changed pretty dramatically. If I take you back to the 80s, commercial real estate wasn't really a mainstream job category. A lot of the folks who were active in commercial real estate back then, it was the second, third, fourth career for them. They had done other things, got into real estate somehow. Today, a lot of colleges, have real estate majors. Kids are getting interested in real estate at a lot younger age. Real estate has become a much more mainstream asset class in terms of institutional investment. So I think it's changed very dramatically. And, interestingly, folks have said to me, well, gee, now with all the new technology you have, the deal process is so much quicker. There must be so much more business going on today than occurred back in the 80s and 90s. And the interesting thing in New York is that each successive decade, there have actually been fewer properties sold. But what technology has done, it has allowed an individual to do significantly more than they could have done in the past. There are years in which I've sold over 100 buildings. There's no way I could possibly do that in the 80s or 90s with the technology the way it was then. So I think what's happened is it actually has allowed fewer people to do more business because you have more horsepower with the strength that technology gives you, but it is it's probably a smaller industry today than it was previously.
It's interesting.
But I think people are getting into it a lot younger today. It was very unusual for me being a college kid to get into real estate as a first job out of school back then. Today, it's very, very commonplace. I mean, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of folks apply for our summer internships. Mm-hmm. Very, very competitive. And I know it's like that at every shop. And, it's great to see that people are getting into real estate at such a young age.
And when as you sort of progress in your real estate career, in New York specifically, what pushes you down the route of doing commercial? Because that's a behemoth that you're taking on. I'm assuming that it's hyper-competitive, the best of the best take it on. This is where you've built your career. So what was the passion in commercial real estate? Because that sounds a little funny, right? Like passion for commercial real estate. It's something that passion for making money, passion for solving a certain problem. How do you get a passion for commercial real estate?
Yeah, it was always fun to, that first summer driving around looking at the buildings. And don't forget, the security in commercial buildings is very, very different in the 80s. I mean, you basically could walk into any building anywhere. The way leasing brokers used to canvas big office towers, you just got in, took the elevator to the top floor, got out and walked into every office and said, hey, let me talk to the guy who makes real estate decisions here. I mean, that's how lax security was back then. I was driving around looking at these buildings and, one building would be an office building and the next one is a retail property and the next one is an industrial building. And you're just looking at all these commercial properties and it was so cool to walk inside them, see what was going on, write down.
Experience it. Experience the money that just goes into some of these organizations and these buildings. It must be wild.
Yeah. So it was just something that I really liked right off the bat. I mean, I always was very statistically and numbers oriented. It all stems from being a baseball card collector as a kid. I was probably one of the few kids that spent more time looking at the backs of the cards than the front of the cards. You know, always liked to look at stats and kept track of my own stats. I was a baseball player, a pitcher as a kid, and, you know, always kept track of those. And then when it came to real estate, that first job was very statistically oriented, figuring out the size of the building, the square footage, writing down a lot of data. And it just really, it resonated with me right off the bat. I never considered getting into residential real estate. It actually is a There are some fundamentals that are similar, but it's a vastly different business.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Think back to your last few days in the office. Did any of them leave you feeling really accomplished? Not the kind of day where you're running around like crazy, but where you've made real progress on something that matters. Because being busy doesn't always mean being productive. And I bet you we've all been there. And maybe it's time to rethink what it means to get things done. Today's episode is sponsored by Belay. And what they help you do is, instead of getting sucked into emails and to-do lists, they help you delegate tasks and focus on big goals. They can connect you with top-notch US-based talent who are ready to take on those time-consuming tasks that bog you down. Let's be real. There are way more important things you could be doing than bookkeeping or wrangling a packed inbox. They have virtual assistants to handle all of those pesky administrative tasks or accounting professionals to take care of all your financials. But here's the best part. You don't have to waste weeks searching for the right person. Belay's personalized matching service works quickly, sometimes matching you with the right talent to take stuff off your plate in under a week. Are you ready to try a different way of working? Check out Belay's list of the top 25 things you can delegate to a virtual assistant. It might just change your business and your life. Text SUCCESS, that's SUCCESS, to 55123 to get the list and to start transforming your to-do list with Belay. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success.
In residential than in commercial.
I am very curious about sort of your entrepreneurial route that you took, and you built your own brokerage, and then obviously you sold it. So, like, very, very entrepreneurial mindset. I want to go down that road and sort of unpack some of the learnings that you obviously figured out as you were building. But I would love to understand just what, for people that are listening that are not in real estate or not in commercial real estate, what does a commercial real estate transaction look like? What does it look like from finding the land, selling the land, buying the land, all the way through to when they start to build? Like, can you just walk us through sort of like a typical transaction and what that looks like, so they understand the scope of work that you would do?
Sure. And I'll start with just kind of an example to give folks a sense of what the business is. And I always try to simplify it in a way that you really can very transparently understand what it is. So let's say I was going to leave New York and I'm going to go to Iceland and I'm going to sell rocks for a living. What I would do is I make up a list of everybody that owns rocks. I'd then study the rock market, understand what different types of rocks sell for, how many there are of each type, look at sales trends and really become an expert on the value of rocks. And then I'd make up a list of everybody that wants to buy rocks. And I would try to develop relationships with the people who own the rocks. And when they want to sell the rocks, I'd ask them to hire me exclusively to be their agent to sell them. And then once I got hired, I'd call all the people that want to buy rocks. And that's the brokerage business in a nutshell. So basically, I have a list of folks that I'm trying to develop relationships with that own real estate in New York. I'm trying to explain to them that, you know, I've done it before. I have the capability. I have expertise in the subject matter. And that if they hire me to sell their building, I'm likely to get them a higher price than if they hire somebody else. So I get hired to sell it, and then we send the information out to the thousands of people that have expressed interest in buying properties here, get folks interested, answer questions for them, give them information about the building, who are the tenants, how much are they paying, how long are the leases, what are the expenses, what kind of return will this investment provide. And then you go through the process of getting people to make offers on the building. Then you deal with the top two, three, four people at the top of the pack, and ultimately, you know, sell to the one that's willing to pay the highest price. So it's a fairly simple business. It's just really hard because it takes a lot of discipline and doing a lot of very basic fundamental blocking and tackling every day.
A lot of relationship building, I'm assuming.
Without a doubt. The key is to be top of mind with somebody, because if you think about the New York market and use Manhattan as a microcosm, south of 96th Street, which is the prime part of Manhattan, there are 27,649 buildings. The average turnover of that stock of buildings has been about 2.6% of the total stock in any one year. Buildings sell only once every 40 years on average. So the idea is to be there when that owner decides, hey, I need to sell. Whatever the reason might be, death, divorce, taxes, partnership disputes, there may be a compelling strategic reason why somebody wants to sell. But you want them, the second after they think, hey, I need to sell, you want the next thing for them to think of is, hey, let me call Bob. And the way you do that is by constantly developing and nurturing a relationship with that owner, sending them market information, calling them, speaking to them all the time, answering questions that they have, always staying in front of them so that you remain on top of mind for them when they decide they need to transact.
So, I mean, there's a long tail to building a successful brokerage. Like you said, it's a lot of blocking and tackling, but there's a lot of relationship work that goes into it up front and has to be maintained. I'm just curious, because you work with a whole bunch of young people and young realtors and people that come into the intern program. Do you find that even the personality of the individual is a little bit different than when you started, and the need for immediate gratification is hurting people's real estate careers? Do you see that?
Not so much. I think that may be part of the way folks are built today, because everything happens so quickly. You know, you get your deliveries same day.
You
need information. You go Google a topic, and within seconds you have the information. Everything happens much quicker today. But I think, you know, we always tell folks in real estate, it's a marathon, not a sprint. You have to build those relationships. You have to take the time to do things properly and not take shortcuts. And I think the folks who do well in our business, the three main things that really stand out and lead to a high probability of success. One is being a true market expert in one niche of the market. The markets are generally so big, so many buildings, so many possible transactions, so many buyers, sellers, tenants, that you want to pick one niche that's a manageable size that you really can become a true expert in and develop that expertise. Second, you have to have passion for it. You have to love it, because no matter how good you are, the market is always cyclical. There are going to be ups and downs, and invariably somebody is going to run into tough times. And if you have passion for it, it's going to give you that intestinal fortitude to fight through the tough times and stick around and be there for the good times. And then the third part is discipline, the discipline to do these things. You know, I love quoting Abraham Lincoln, who said that discipline is choosing between what you want now and what you want most. And if you keep your eye on the prize, understand what you want most, where you want to get to, what your macro objectives are, and you're not dissuaded from maintaining focus on those things, you know, you're able to do the nuts and bolts things that you have to do day in and day out to make sure that you achieve that long-term objective.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. Now, the Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network. So if you like this show, you'll love some of the other shows in their network. One of my personal favorites is the Hustle Daily Show. It brings you a healthy dose of irreverent, offbeat, and informative takes on business and tech news, and you guessed it, every single day. Some of their recent episodes that were my personal favorites: how AI is making fake IDs, how to meet your favorite CEO for a few $1,000s, and also how TikTok is turning into an online mall and starting to replace QVC. If you love business, if you want to get it daily, listen to the Hustle Daily Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Very, very smart. What prompted you to start to build your own brokerage? And that's that was a very successful exit. You sold that. You sold the Massey Knackle Realty Services for over $100 million. So wildly successful by any business standards, entrepreneurial standards. So where did that come from? Where did you start that? How did you grow it? How did you differentiate from all the other brokerages to get to that level?
Yeah, well, at CB back in the 80s, we were trying to implement a territory system. And a couple of years in, one of the senior guys who had been there for a while came up with a transaction in Paul Massey and my territory, and went to the boss and said, "Hey, I'm not going to bring these kids in on this deal. I've known this guy for a long time. I'm not going to do it." And the boss said, "Okay." And we're like, "Hey, that's not fair. We were supposed to be operating on a set of guidelines and principles." So we're like, "Hey, man, we're out of here." And so we went down to Chemical Bank at the time and saw our banker and said, "Hey, we need $500,000 as a business loan. We're going to start a business. Where do we sign?" And of course, the banker laughs at us and says, "Hey, guys, that's not the way it works. Go out, start your business, come back after you've been in business for 3 years and have a track record, and maybe we'll talk about giving you a revolving credit line." So we were depressed, went back to the office, and for the next 2 years, we saved money out of every transaction we did, saved up enough. We had about $400,000 to start the business. And went in November of 88, started our firm. We were absolutely dead set on having an operating platform that we would not deviate from in any way, so that another young guy wouldn't feel like he was not being treated fairly. So the rules in our platform applied to us just as it did to somebody in their first day on the job. That worked out really well for us. So we implemented a geographic territory system. There were rules and guidelines. It incentivized expertise. It incentivized collaboration. and was a key ingredient in the success that the firm had.
How long did it take you to get it off the ground? Like, tell me some entrepreneurial story of just
a long time. How about that? You know, 88 was a good year. You know, stock market had crashed in October of 87. 88 was still a good year in the real estate market. Things moved more slowly back then. But 89, the volume of sales started to dry up. By 1990, we were in the heat of the savings and loan crisis. We had, at one point in 1990, had $15,000 in the bank. Our burn rate was $15,000 a month. And we said, you know, what the heck do we do? Do we pay all the bills next month and then hope that we close a deal? Do we pay $5,000 a month for the next 3 months of the most important bills, keep the phones on and keep the lights on? And it occurred to us that we had really good credit. So we went to every bank in town and said, hey, we'll get a $2,000 credit card at this bank and a $4,000 credit card at that bank. And between two of us, we had about $60,000 in credit card lines. So that was 4 months of operating the business. So we ran for a couple of years on those lines. And then we also ran out of money again because the banks at that time were going through what was a 2 or 3 year foreclosure process. They would then get title to the property and then started selling. And that selling really started in 93, as I recall, in a big wave. We had the credit cards maxed out of money again in 92. So we went to one of our super rich clients and said, hey, we need a $75,000 loan. We've done some business with you. It seems like you like us. Would you give us 75 grand? And he said, you know what? I really like you boys. I'll give you the 75, but I want 50% of the stock in your business.
Oh, that's pricey.
thanks. Let us think about it. And of course we were depressed and, we didn't have any family members that we could go to directly, but, Paul had a stepfather-in-law that was in the mortgage brokerage business in New Jersey, a guy by the name of Jack Holler. And we went out to see Jack and we said, hey, Jack, we need 75 grand. We'll give you 25% of the stock in the business. And you know, people often ask, you know, what was the kindest thing anybody ever did for you? This was it. Jack said, guys, I'm going to give you the 75 grand. Don't want the 25% of the stock. Someday you're going to be very successful and you'll be upset that you gave me the stock. So not going to do that. And, you know, it was a great thing. Got us through until the market started revolving again, you know, volume started to happen. And, you know, it was a great thing he did for us. So the company started to make money by 93, 94. But personally, I lived on credit cards from 1988 to 1998.
10 years.
My net worth fluctuated between zero and minus 180,000 because I had gotten my own personal lines up to 180,000 on credit cards. You know, it was a wild ride, but worth every minute of it.
Most people, I don't think, would stick it out that long. That's tough. That's a tough 10 years. But that's sometimes what it takes. So that's sometimes what it takes. And then you hit when the markets turn around, because that's the thing too, right? Like, I'm assuming, you know, you can be the best broker, you can be a great marketer, you can have good relations, but like market impacts in a major way, even if you have all those things.
Yeah. And we believed that, you know, someday it would work out. We believed in what we were doing.
Yeah.
Always loved the job, even during the tough times. So, you know, we stuck it out. Fortunately, everything worked out.
And like you've made some really bold moves. I mean, I think after the September 11th, 9/11 terrorist attacks, everybody was downsizing. You were hiring aggressively.
Today's sponsor is BetterHelp. Now, hear me out. if you magically had an extra hour in a day, and I know sometimes that's the only time we get to ourselves, what would you do with it? Maybe you would catch up on sleep. Maybe you'd hit the gym. Maybe you'd finally get into that book that you've been eyeing. We're always wishing for more time. But what if we focused on how we use the time that we have? Think about what really lights you up. What would change in your life if you made that a priority? Do you even know what that thing is? Well, therapy has been a game changer for me, not because of some terrible thing that's happened to me, but because it's helped me figure out what matters, how to manage tough emotions, how to be a better friend, a partner, business person, and just really person all around. So if you're even a little curious about therapy, if you want to help think through what matters to you, what to prioritize, how to live your life, try BetterHelp. It's totally online and works around your crazy schedule. No awkward waiting rooms. Just get matched with a licensed therapist and start making the most of the time you've already got. Learn how to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/successpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/successpod. Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security, audits, and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary for 2 weeks free.
So you have a certain style of leadership that's worked out, but even walk me through that decision, because that's like a small example of how you lead and how you built, I think is very, very important.
Yeah, that was a big inflection point in the history of the company. Up until that time, I think in 9/11, we had 21 people. Up to that point, Paul and I had done all the hiring ourselves, all the interviewing, hiring, et cetera. And we saw every company downsizing. A lot of companies were scared, and the great quality people were out on the street without a job, you know, brokers, bankers, lawyers, accountants. And we're like, there's great quality people out there, and New York is tough. We're going to bounce back from this. And we went out and hired a director of HR and said, you know what, let's go hire all these great people. And 2 years later, we had 150 people. We had opened offices in Queens and Brooklyn. And we did that at a time when, most Manhattan brokers thought their shoes would get too dirty if they went across the river to the outer boroughs. Now it's very cool to be in the outer boroughs. But we had those offices open and fully staffed. And so when the markets really started to do well in the outer boroughs, we already had tremendous boots on the ground and really had very dominant market share in investment sales in the outer boroughs, particularly at that time. And that move, Scott, could have just totally put us out of business. But we believed in New York City. We believed in our platform had a bunch of great people come on board. And it was a fun ride.
So did you do something similar during COVID with a lot of people losing their jobs? Did you pick up talent? I know it's not your company anymore, but was that the strategy?
Yeah, well, it's a different situation now. JLL is a huge company. We have 102,000 employees worldwide. And, the group that I run in New York is the private capital group. And the folks who are the main producers in that business were all folks that I've been working with back to the Massey-Nackle days. We probably have an average tenure of about 25 years together. So that we didn't increase our headcount all that much during the downturn, but still as much fun as it used to be.
I love it. Tell me, as you're building out the firm, that was one bold move you took. What was one of the worst decisions that you made? One of the shit hit the fan moments when you were building it out?
Oh gosh,
probably many.
Well, I'll tell you the one very early on. It's not really a big one, but just emblematic of the fact that you had two guys running a business that didn't really know what the hell they were doing. We went to a printer to get report covers done, and they were a black report cover with a white box in the middle and then our green logo in the middle of the white box. And these were going to be the covers that went on the reports that we gave to clients and that kind of thing. And we get them back from the printer and pick them up, and all of a sudden our thumbs are black. And we're like, what the heck is going on? And we went to the cheapest printer out there, you know, not somebody that was really that good. They didn't put varnish on them. So we called the guy up and said, hey, man, you didn't put varnish on these. He said, you didn't ask for varnish. Would have been more if we put varnish on. So we're like, we can't use these. So what we did, you know, we're small. It's just me, Paul, Ed Winslow, who was the first salesman we hired, Jim Ventura, who was a second salesman we hired, who's a kindergarten friend of mine, and a secretary. And we send the secretary down to the Duane Reade drugstore. We said, go buy 5 cans of hairspray. So we take a newspaper, spread it out on the floor of the office, put these report covers down, and we're spraying them with hairspray so that when it dried, you could touch it and not get black ink all over your fingers. So, you know, that was one of the things. Another thing we said to our secretary, hey, we want you to keep the books and write the checks and take care of all that stuff, not knowing that she didn't know how to balance a checkbook. And she came to us one time a couple of years in. It's like, oh, guys, by the way, you know, and she was just stuffing bills in the drawer and forgetting about them. We, you know, our burn rate was $15,000 a month. We had $60,000 in unpaid bills that we had to deal with. So another, a lot of trial and error. And I will say that the biggest mistakes that we made were made because we didn't think enough to ask people who had been there and done that for advice. So yeah, we did way too many things like that by trial. We didn't make any really giant mistake that really cost us, but a series, hundreds and hundreds of these small mistakes that added up. And I think we could have avoided many of them if we had just thought to ask senior people for advice and that kind of thing. And then in later years, we actually had an advisory board of very senior people in the business world and the real estate world that helped us tremendously and learned our lesson about trial and error and how that's not the best way to do things. So I guess the answer is a lot of small paper cuts we got along the way, but fortunately nothing big that
serious. So then, you know, 26 years later in 2014, that's when you sold Cushman & Wakefield for $100 million. So incredible exit. You went back to work the next week, which I think is hilarious. Good for you. Listen, I like your attitude. I like how you look at work. I think it's important. Fast forward, you always are a hard worker. I think that's something that's sort of you know, it's been throughout your entire career. You're a very hard worker. In 2020, you walked every block of Manhattan to document all these development sites. So you always do things. The best way I can put them is a little bit outside the box and a little bit analog in a world where everybody's trying to optimize and do things in a digital way. Nothing wrong with that. It helps people work quicker, faster, but you still do things and get your hands dirty like you do. So what was the point of that project?
Yeah, well, that was actually something I had wanted to do for about 10 years. I sell a lot of development sites in New York. Those development sites are typically made up of a bunch of little small buildings that get knocked down to make way for a new big building. And in order to value land properly, you really need to know what the supply pipeline looks like of similar properties that your new property that you're going to build is going to compete with. So there's very opaque information about the pipeline of new development in New York. The best data set that's available is in the residential space for condominiums, although all the big residential firms produce reports that are all great, but they're very different from each other. Some count things that others don't, and it's really hard to get a sense of what's really out there. So for years, I wanted to go out and actually count the buildings that are under construction. You're standing in front of a site. You know whether there's a building under construction or not. You can see whether it's there or not. And, you know, doing it on Google Earth or something like that, you know, that may be 6 months old or 9 months old, not up to date with regard to today. So I wanted to get out and actually do it. And during the pandemic, I had gotten out of town. There were some rumors that they were going to quarantine the entire city and shut all the bridges and tunnels. So I took my wife and my daughter up to our country house in Connecticut. We left kind of in a hurry when we heard that rumor. We didn't want to be stuck in the city. A couple of, you know, we were told, go home for 2 weeks, then come back, everything will be fine. So it was very clear 2 weeks later that we weren't going to come back and everything wasn't going to be normal. So we left in such a haste that I had to go back into the city to get some stuff. And I'm driving down the FDR Drive and get into Manhattan, and it was like a ghost town, Scott. Unbelievable. No stores were open. There were no people on the street. There were no cars moving. And I'm driving to my apartment, and it occurred to me, you know what? If I'm ever going to walk around the city, this is the perfect time to do it. So I called up the folks I work with. I said, hey, let's make copies of that Sanborn tax lot map. I'm going to go out into the field. I brought one of them with me each time. We drive a car to point A, get out, walk around for a half hour, drive to point B, get out, walk around for a half hour. And we color coded everything on the map. For buildings that were under construction, buildings that had been demolished, buildings that looked like potential development sites and assemblages where you're putting together multiple properties, and then came back. Since we did that, it was about 220 hours in the field, walked every street of Manhattan, south of 96th on the east side and 110 on the west side, have done thousands of hours of research after that, figuring out what the pipeline is. So now, in terms of the pipeline of new construction, we've broken it into five buckets: residential rental units, condo units, hotels, offices, and then a miscellaneous bucket. We have it down to the square inch for everything that's being done in the city, the deals that are actively under construction, sites that are in the planning stage, potential sites that we're prospecting to. We're doing all of that stuff, and you know, it's been great. It's allowed us to value properties very accurately. It's given our clients great insights into the market. Since we did the field work, we've been tracking every demolition permit, foundation permit, and building permit that has been filed, so it's completely up to date. When I have clients come in, we're constantly modifying the map with inside information that they're giving us about deals they're working on, and it's been a great thing.
It's interesting. Like, I mean, you gotta niche down. You gotta be an expert in your field. You gotta do the hard work. Like, these are just good tenets of building a strong business. Now you have the map room. Huge competitive advantage because you walk the streets, you've done the work, you've done the research. It's actually funny that even in 2024, the map room you built by walking the streets is still the competitive advantage, and it's not sitting on the internet somewhere. It's very interesting, right?
You know, people have said, hey, Bob, I do digital stuff. I can digitize it for you. Yeah. Don't want it digitized because looking at it on a computer screen is very different. And I mean, you see behind me, you have sections of the map on the wall. I'll show you this table has the big map.
Oh, yeah. But
they're individual and it's nothing new. I'm going to show you a picture from, I'm not sure exactly what year, but this is the early 90s. And that's me sitting at my desk with maps on the wall. So as much
as it works.
Much as the world has changed, the world has stayed the same.
Amen. All right. To finish this off, I want to get like a website, social. Where do you want to send people if they want to connect with you, sort of learn what you're working on? What's the best place to go?
Sure. Well, you could always email me at bob.mackle@jll.com, or I'm on all the social media platforms, very active on LinkedIn and Twitter. Happy to have you DM me or email me, and be happy. Anybody has any real estate questions, happy to answer them.
Amazing. All right, last two questions, rapid fire. First one, if you could look back and tell your 20-year-old self one thing, what would it be?
Don't do things by trial and error. And ask older people who have the experience and have been there and done that for their advice, and you'll save a lot of time and effort.
Good. And then if you look forward now, what does success mean for you in the future?
Yeah, well, I think success really has to do with the sense of peace that you ultimately get to in your life. And I think that's something we're all striving for. We talk about work-life balance. We talk about things that are important to us. But I think the extent to which you can sit down at the end of the day and feel like you have peace within you, that you've treated people right, you've done the right thing, you live a good life. I think that to me is success.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.